Have you ever noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things that they run on? And that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass just whatever legislation they like. They are bound by the Overton window. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians typically only act within a narrow window of policy ideas. And on the Overton Window podcast, we talk with people who work to shift the Overton Window and change what is politically possible. I'm Mike Van Beek, and joining me today is Barbara Oakley. Barb is a professor at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. She studies lots of things: statistics, neuroscience, bioengineering, industrial and systems engineering, and more. She also teaches the world's largest online class, which will be the topic of our conversation today. So, Barb, welcome to the Overton Window podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, tell us about your online class.
So, it's one of the world's largest massive open online courses. It's on Coursera, and I teach it with the neuroscientist Terry Sanowski, who's he's probably he's a great neuroscientist, shall we say. He's one of the few living human beings who's simultaneously a member of all three national academies, engineering, medicine, and science. But we teach about learning from a neuroscientific perspective, using metaphors to help people go deeper. And it's a really fun course. We have like so much fun. I did the editing for it. So Terry's such a good sport. So I could have like a little zombie coming out from behind his head. Just all sorts of cool stuff, which is getting even cooler now because we're using AI to make some of the graphics really remarkable. But the thing is, when that course first came out in 2014, it was right after sort of what the New York Times had framed as the year of the MOOC. And it was supposed to be the year that online learning would really take over and start speeding up. And the sort of the Overton window at that time was that online learning is really going to take over education. And I think there was a lot of pushback about that from education. And I do believe that education is one of the, shall we say, the most inertial of enterprises. There's not much desire for change, although there's a lot of clamoring that, you know, they are very desirous of change, but a lot of the things that they want to change to, I saw exactly 30 years ago, framed in exactly the same way. So anyway, in these past 10 years, I've kind of watched as the world of online courses has evolved, and I think there's been so much pushback from education towards online learning that at least for the present, the Overton window has shifted back into online learning is never as good as face-to-face, even though the research evidence doesn't show that at all. But as soon as something like another epidemic or something of that nature might unfold, suddenly we will again see a shift, as we saw in 2020 with COVID. And I believe that we need to really be prepared for the inevitable vicissitudes that could arise that will need us to have online learning available to keep people going and learning.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about COVID because it seems to me like it had an impact on people's opinions about online learning, but not necessarily a positive one, because I mean, in one way, maybe it was positive because many schools were able to successfully transition to online learning in a in a massive scale. But a lot of people didn't like or have a good experience with the content or with the process of the actual learning then that happened. Or, I mean, maybe too little learning happened. And obviously we have lots of evidence about the impact on standardized test scores and things like that from that period. So what are your thoughts there? What is going to be the legacy of that COVID experience with online learning?
You know, I remember thinking at the time it occurred, I mean, everything exploded in the world of online teaching. We were getting 40,000 students a week signing up for our course. And you would think that people would have really grasped how powerful online teaching and online learning can be. But at universities and at schools, people in general don't know how to teach online. It requires more care. I mean, if you get it all prepared, it's way easier than teaching a regular face-to-face class. But people didn't really, you know, when COVID happened, it was kind of like, oh my gosh, how do I get on Zoom? You know, even get on Zoom, much less teach through Zoom. And so there was a lot of really bad stuff out there. And I think that left a bad taste in people's mouths. Now, there are some countries like Singapore, for example, they are very cognizant that things can happen. So what they've done is mandated, for example, that their K-12 schools, one day a month has to be online. And so that what that does is that kind of keeps teachers with a little skin in the game, and that they kind of have to learn some of these things. And there's, at least at some universities, there's a big push to make sure that at least some courses that students take are online, and they're well planned and well made. Well made online courses are really they're just as good and in some ways better than face-to-face courses, because people will say, oh, face-to-face is always better, but then they have this like imagined like perfect person who's teaching the perfect face-to-face course, and they're comparing that with some really shoddy online experience. But the reality is half of all teachers face-to-face are below average. And so what that really means is you can have a much better chance of finding good teaching materials online than you can, if you're in the face-to-face world. But, how can I put this? The framing, of that window, it shifted, because when you get a lot of negativity about learning online, people kind of pick up on that, and I think that's kind of what happened. So that's why online learning has kind of shifted into the background now, but it will reemerge, when it's needed, and I think it's best to be prepared for it.
Yeah. What are some of the distinct benefits of an online course compared to the traditional, typical classroom experience?
Well, I think it was perhaps best. So we can talk about K-12 courses, or we can talk about university courses, and we can talk about courses for people who are professionals working in the in the regular world. And so from a K-12 perspective, there was a young woman, an eighth grader, I believe, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and this was during COVID. And she said, in essence, she didn't wish anything bad on people with COVID, but she was so delighted at what happened in education because, or her own personal experience, because it had been that when you were in class, there's such a big push towards cooperative learning, learning in groups and so forth. And frankly, it's easy for teachers to have that kind of thing because it's like, go off, you guys figure it out. And so she wasn't learning anything. She was just being the one who often just got stuck with doing whatever project. And so she'd end up doing it mostly or all of it herself. And she ended up during COVID getting online and actually being taught in a way that was not disruptive. People weren't dropping things and talking to each other. She could actually focus on what was being taught and she could concentrate. And you can pause the video when you want to think about what you're learning. And she loved it. And in fact, that's what I believe it's the world's largest master's course or program is at Georgia Tech. And this program has over 10,000 students. It's incredibly inexpensive. So if you're looking for a master's degree in data science or computer programming, go look at Georgia Tech's online program. And it costs $6,600 for the whole 2 year, the master's degree, as opposed to $45,000 if someone attended face-to-face, yet you get exactly the same diploma. And when they test the outcomes, as far as the students are concerned, they're equivalent. So you can take this master's degree if you're, in the backwoods of Tennessee or, a way out on a ship. In the Pacific Ocean, doesn't matter. You can take it from afar, and it's really inexpensive. So there's just so much to like about online learning. And from my perspective, I love to be able to look at a teacher who's world class, who can explain things really well, and you can get great visuals and so forth, and you can stop whenever you want, and you can really focus in a way that's often easier than in a real life class.
So Georgia Tech, you got the $40,000 in-person experience, the $6,000 online experience. People are still buying the $40,000. Like they haven't all gone to the online class. So I wonder, what is it about, what sort of value are people getting out of attending in person? And they're obviously, revealed preference. They're willing to pay a premium to do that. What do you think is the value there? I guess maybe more broadly, what are some of the benefits of face-to-face that, that maybe can't be replicated online?
Well, that's a great question. Their in-person audience is way smaller. So the number of people who choose to attend Georgia Tech face-to-face is not nearly as many as the online program, but still there are a few. And I'm just kind of guessing they may be very wealthy coming from other countries, and they're looking for a reason to come and visit the U.S. and kind of be in an immersive experience. Mm-hmm. They might be from Georgia, so that they might get a lesser expensive tuition. You can meet people face-to-face, and it can be valuable. But this thing is, you're meeting the people who are in your cohort, and that's true whether you're online or in a smaller face-to-face group. Online, you're meeting an international cohort and getting to know those individuals. So I guess it's probably what is your preference. You know, maybe there are people who want to stay close to home, or there are adventurers who come from countries where they get free tuition and they can go wherever they want. Or, you know, I guess it's my guess is just people have different preferences that way.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the development of online learning and the acceptance and you know, the policy window of what's politically possible with this has shifted, and some of it's because there's pushback from education institutions, colleges, I assume you mean, that kind of thing. Can you talk more about that? Like, what does that pushback look like? Is it like a policy-led thing, or is it more of something different?
Well, I remember being asked several times to put my application in and go to certain major universities. And when I would put the application in as I was requested, it would go through the faculty, and the faculty would say, you know, if there was anything she was doing except teaching these massive open online courses, her credentials are impeccable. This is fantastic, but we don't want someone who's known for teaching online courses, because it might lead some of our faculty to believe that we are very supportive of online courses and that we want to go that route. And as, you know, as faculty members and particularly as administrators, we don't want to have the faculty viewing us in that way. So that was some of the, you know, behind the scenes feedback that I got. I often find, so overseas, there's a completely different perspective on online learning than in the U.S. It's really quite fascinating. For example, Kazakhstan has something like 30-some different universities that have laid a foothold, a foundation within Kazakhstan to teach and also to teach online courses. And they're very, very big on bringing Coursera courses because one of the hardest things that universities will tacitly acknowledge if you discuss things behind the scenes is the hardest thing they find is to get their own faculty to upskill, to keep current. And you will always have a few who are really with it and really working hard. But, you know, once you get tenure, it's pretty easy to fall into a glide pattern. And one thing I find overseas is that, for example, if you're taking some online courses, you know, your university has kind of enlisted in something where you're getting the best generative AI coursework from Stanford, from Vanderbilt, from Princeton. It actually upskills not only your students but your faculty, and they really see that and they appreciate it. I think within the U.S., though, it can be a little bit more of, you know, what did they used to say about AT&T when AT&T owned everything? It's like, oh, we don't care. We don't have to. I think U.S. Universities often think they're kind of at the top of their game, and they don't really need to be nudged into learning something, and they certainly don't want their students kind of seeing world-class instructors who might compete with some of their own instructors. So it's a very strange world, in that the world outside the U.S. is quite interested in online learning, but the U.S. itself is, shall we say, reticent in many cases, except if you are out in the working world yourself. So if you move away from looking at it from a university or a school perspective, wow, people in who are working out in business, they are just out in the world. You can be just interested in things. Are you interested in, photography or history or what have you? Are you interested in upskilling your understanding of, various aspects of generative AI? I mean, Coursera's got like some of the best courses in the world. And they work with Google. They work with, so Amazon and so forth. So, you really have courses that are on subjects that people can actually use, learn, and grow from. And of course, learning how to learn is really helpful there, because it's the foundational skill that helps you much more easily grasp the material in these other courses.
Yeah. And you mentioned AI a few times. I wonder what, if you could talk more about that and what you think the impact might be of AI software on online learning, and how it might impact its effectiveness or acceptance, or maybe it'll be a challenge. I don't know.
I have a love-hate relationship with AI. So, and I think, many teachers and many professors are similar, in that AI has pulled the rug out from under us in all the methods that we have long used. I mean, we're talking centuries, that we've always used to evaluate and to help students learn, like having them write essays or having them do homework sets and so forth. Well, that's suddenly not in the offing. And educators haven't been prepared to deal with this, because a lot of the insights that they have about how people learn effectively, at least in Western countries, are based on constructivist approaches that minimize the importance of memory, and and are trying to maximize that everything needs to be more fun. And the thing is, when you get to these very high university levels, everything can't be fun. It's a little hard sometimes, and some of these concepts are really hard, but if you can grasp them, you can really, it can greatly benefit your job. So, let's see. So, I don't know if that kind of addresses what you were bringing up, but hopefully.
Yeah. Or, you said you were using some AI components, or using AI in your design of your class now. Could you talk more about how that works and how that might improve your online class?
Oh, let me count the ways. So I teach online, and so I make a lot of videos. When I'm making videos, they need to, I mean, each video is like a couple class segments. So part of what we've found from neuroscience is if you can get people curious about what you're going to be teaching, it enhances dopamine, a sort of throughout areas of the brain that you are using. And that once a person gets that curiosity satisfied, that dopamine kind of hones in there and helps to link neurons together to create memories, engrams. And this can help you to form the schema, the foundational framework of information as you're acquiring expertise in whatever you're learning. So I can input a script into AI and say, what's a good hook that I can use to start this class on electromagnetic theory? What is a good metaphor for entropy and why entropy increases when energy flows from hot to cold, even though the amount of energy stays the same? What's a good metaphor for that? It will, if you ask for a metaphor, it will tell you some of the coolest metaphors. You know, and you could tell them a little bit about your students. Like when I was in Mongolia, that they were complaining there that their students came off the Mongolian steppe, and so they just had no interest in learning about Python programming. So I was like, you know, they said, what do we do? And we're just city professors. We don't know how to talk to these students and get them interested. I'm like, go to ChatGPT, tell them about, you know, main guard and scope and ask for a metaphor. And it gives great metaphors in terms of yurts and migratory patterns and things that the students coming off the Mongolian steppe could actually grasp, be familiar with, and even some cool inside jokes that they could appreciate. So AI can really help you in your teaching. The best teaching kind of interweaves explanation with practice on the part of the student, with more explanation, you know, and feedback and so forth. It's a dance between student and professor or teacher. And AI can help you know how to structure that dance so it's most effective in whatever you're trying to teach.
Wow, yeah, that's really interesting. And it seems to me that you know, we don't really know yet what all the different uses are going to be and benefits of some of these different AI systems. And I think they will continuously evolve. And so our use of them will continuously evolve as well, and we'll find all different kinds of ways to use them. I've never heard of AI being good at generating metaphors. That's great. That might be helpful for some of the work we do here of trying to explain certain complicated policy issues. Metaphors are very helpful for that purpose. So what about the future of online learning? What do you see? Is it, you know, you mentioned the window has shifted to maybe a little bit of backsliding, a little, you know, people questioning it more and trying to block it. Do you think with AI, it will continue to evolve and grow and have more of an influence or not?
Oh, I think it will continue to go along, and there's some interesting new developments in many different platforms. So, of course, I'm most familiar with Coursera, but one of their kind of novel new creations is just the Socratic dialogue, where when you're learning something, you can actually talk back and forth sort of with the kind of almost with the instructor and figure out whether you really understand the material. And it can more or less quiz you on the material. And I think this is great. One thing I would love to see improve over the coming years, and I'm sure it will, is we can do so much more now and so much more easily with generative AI videos that it's like I did a course on, it's called Speak Freely, Think Critically, and it's about, ostensibly about free speech, and it is, but it's really about how important it is to listen to others, because sometimes you're not going to be going out crusading and converting everybody to your beliefs. In fact, sometimes when you go out crusading, you can cause people to dig in more. But this course starts out with Ibn Khaldun, the famous Arab sociologist of the 1400s, descending from Damascus's walls to meet Tamerlane, the invader who was going to burn the city and so forth. So I'm standing on the ramparts of Damascus, watching the battle going on, coughing as smoke goes by me, and putting context, historical context, into these extraordinary ways that groups of people think and try to make societies cohesive, and why individual ideas are also important. But, we can do this now. We can present these kinds of melding together of neuroscience, of history, of law, of, all these kinds of different things with wonderful videos that we've never been able to do before.
That is fascinating. Barb, thanks so much for being on the Overton Window podcast. We have run out of time already, but it was a pleasure speaking with you, and hope to work with you again in the future.
I look forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.